Hello, aliens, ghosts, and robots. Welcome back to An Invisible Sun. It's me, Keith, and hello. Hope you're doing okay. I have some exciting news. As of this recording, the winter solstice of 2024 is rapidly approaching. It'll be this weekend, in fact. And with that, I bring another edition of the Equinox Science Fiction Anthology to podcast platforms everywhere. If you checked out the one that was released in the fall, Equinox, we had six amazing stories for some great talent in the indie audio drama sphere, and we're doing the same thing again this time around for winter. This time, the theme is unexpected gifts. I, too, have a story in this set, but you're also going to hear stories from Daniel Curis of The Beat of Baleful Wings, Brady Flanagan of Rogue Life, Andy Thierfelder of Palaver Media and Tapes from Beyond, Andrew Wardlaw of the Lamplighter Radio Play, and Chris Balso of The Wizard Scroll. All six short sci-fi stories will arrive on podcast platforms everywhere on December 21st. So I hope you will tune in and give a listen, and then check out the creators and their other shows and projects and support them as well. You can find links to the creators and their works and more information about the anthology at alienghostrobot.com/equinox. All right, here's today's episode of An Invisible Sun. An Invisible Sun by W. Keith Timms. Chapter 20. Oliver shook me awake, lightly.
Sister Lucy says Barwise doesn't have long. He's requested the litany, and she's holding it for him. A few others on the station are here. The litany?
I rubbed my eyes. They felt sore and swollen. My throat felt like sandpaper, too.
Something Lucy came up with years ago. You should come. I'm not a religious person. Yeah, neither am I. But I'm going. It's not the kind of litany you're thinking of. And it's important.
He left me, and I disentangled myself from the cargo netting to massage my temples and try to focus. My body felt like it had been beaten with clubs. Joints aching, muscles weak. After a moment, I remembered the drone. I checked the airlock, but it was still empty. How long had I been asleep? Back in the main area of the salvage room, the place was full of people. In addition to us, there were two dozen or more Marlians in their work clothes and grimy jumpsuits, all gathered around Barwise's bed. Their faces were solemn as they talked quietly amongst themselves. A couple stood at Barwise's head, smiling at him, chatting in the patois of the station. The man in the bed smiled back, albeit weakly. As emaciated and empty as he looked, a weight seemed to have lifted in him. There was a lightness in his bruised eyes, and a genuine warmth in the smile on his split, chapped lips. I looked around for Catherine, but didn't see her. Oliver stood with Baptiste, the station manager. I saw the medic from earlier in the crowd. I wondered if he had my results yet. Sister Lucy appeared from behind a rack of engine parts, her usually calm demeanor a little more focused, a little more serene. As she moved to stand at Barwise's bed, she placed her hand on his shoulder and then addressed all of us.
Today, we gather to speak the litany and to honor our brother Aubrey Barwise, who did not forget.
There's something significant about the way she said those last four words, something which everyone here seemed to understand by their nodding heads and quiet murmurs. Sister Lucy looked down at Barwise kindly.
What verse of the litany shall we recite, Aubrey?
His jaw and throat worked awkwardly And the computerized voice spoke for him. Lucy brushed her fingers across his sparse, tufted hair.
Very appropriate. We will use the simple litany today. Let us begin.
Everyone straightened up, watching her. Her voice was clear and precise.
Lest we forget.
Everyone in the room in unison answered her.
Lest we forget.
Sister Lucy began a formal call and response.
Itai Disease, Toyama Prefecture, Japan.
And then the room responded as one voice.
1912.
Camp American University, Spring Valley, Washington, D.C.
1917.
Hawk's Nest Tunnel, West Virginia.
1931.
The antiphony continued with no hesitations or uncertainties from the people in the crowd. Their expressions focused. They had all said this many times, and they were clear about what they meant.
Hooker Chemical, Love Canal, New York.
1942.
Disasters. They were listing chemical disasters. Memories of various history books and articles come back to me, things I hadn't thought about in forever, or things I hadn't thought about at all after I read about them. Itai disease was caused by some sort of poison released because of mining practices. Love Canal was a toxic waste dump that was covered over and forgotten. Spring Valley was the site of chemical weapons testing during World War I. And the litany kept coming.
Chiso Corporation, Minamata, Japan. Windscale Fire, Cumbria, England.
1957.
Lest we forget.
Lest we forget.
Lago Agrio, Ecuador.
1964.
As I listened, the pattern became clear. After every fifth item in the litany, every fifth memory of some horrible event, Sister Lucy would say, "Lest we forget," and everyone would answer her in one emphatic voice.
Lest we forget.
I didn't know the responses myself, so I didn't answer. But all these people knew these dates, and presumably these events. More of them went by, some of which I had heard of, some not. How is it these ice miners and machinists knew about Union Carbide in Bhopal and Chernobyl in Ukraine, yet I, supposedly an expert in history, hadn't thought about them in years? I noticed Matthew detaching himself quietly from the perimeter of the group and moving to the airlock alone. He peered through the window, searching. The dark corner of the compartment cast shadows over his tattooed features. He looked grim, worried. The litany was continuing, but I didn't know the dates, and I couldn't keep up. I slipped away and moved to the airlock, too. He glanced over at me for a moment as I arrived, but then went back to looking at the emptiness outside.
Still no sign of it.
I kept my voice quiet so as not to disturb the litany. He shook his head.
We've already been here too long.
Sandoz Chemical, Schweizerhalle, Switzerland.
1986.
Exxon Valdez, Prince William Sound, Alaska.
1989.
Lest we forget.
Lest we forget.
Zaragoza.
You're not participating?
Accident.
No.
Why not?
I understand how important it is, but I can't afford the distraction right now.
The litany. They've memorized the major chemical disasters through history?
Yes, for this litany. There are others. Litany of slaughter. Litany of war. Litany of slavery. Remember the past to save the future.
And you all remember all these things? Not just the dates, but what they are?
Not all of them, no. Well, maybe Sister Lucy does. But that's not the point. One person doesn't have to remember them all. If everyone remembers some of the litany, then we will together remember all of it.
He shrugged and folded his strong arms over his chest.
But even so, even if you don't remember what a particular part of the litany is, the fact that it's there is enough to keep you from forgetting that terrible things happen.
I suppose you're right. I hadn't thought about some of those events in years.
People cannot see beyond the ends of their fingers.
He held his large hands out in front of him as if trying to grasp a ghost.
Humans are very good at forgetting. You will remember the worst things that happen in your life. But even those things fade, become vague. They change and lessen with time. It's how we survive, why we don't give up. With time, we forget. And so, keep doing terrible things to each other. Is that why you're here?
He stared out the window once more.
I am here because Sister Lizzie needs someone like me. Someone who can do hard things for her. She does not need the weight. She carries enough.
Hard things. You're a soldier?
Was.
What happened?
For a moment, I didn't think he was going to answer me. His jaw was set, his eyes steely, fixed on the window and the emptiness outside.
I joined the military for the same reason most people do.
You wanted to serve your country, to protect people, to make a difference?
I wanted a job. Turns out, I was good at it.
So that means you were involved in...
I was in many operations. Bangladesh, Somalia, Argentina.
You've seen a lot of action.
I killed a lot of people, is what you mean.
I didn't mean to, I'm sorry.
Why?
Well, because that must have been hard.
He went quiet again for another long moment, thinking this over.
Killing someone is easy, and it's a convenient way to solve problems if you don't think too hard about what you've done. Of course, it's hard afterwards, but they teach you how to pretend it's not. Humans are very good at forgetting, pretending like our actions don't matter, or the ends justify the means.
But back on Mars,
yes, people might have died in the cave-in I caused. I accept that. I could have taken away their lives, their choices. But if I had not taken the risk, they would have taken away our lives, our choices. We always want a peaceful solution, but there is no peace in oppression.
I had to remind myself that this man, who is so comfortable with death, was also the one who rescued me from the trampling crowd at the subway station. He was compassionate and gentle then. Under that calm facade lurked contradictions.
Why did you leave the military then?
There was a time when people fought for their country because they were their country. The country was the people. And if the country was threatened, that meant the people were threatened. In a real way, not by some abstract political threat. Soldiers were fighting for their families and neighbors. Armies were people you knew. Armies were everyone. But armies aren't people anymore. Soldiers are people, but not armies. That's because countries aren't people anymore. Politicians are people, but not countries. But in war, countries and armies don't die. People do. For what? Agendas and resources and ideology. For mine and yours. For abstractions. For phantoms.
He leaned against the airlock door, his attention flicking between the porthole and me.
If it is necessary for me to kill someone, I want to do it for something real. For my neighbors, for my friends, for the people. Not a country. Not an idea with no substance or values.
He gestured toward the litany going on behind me.
That's why things like the litany are important. If we forget, then the real things become ghosts. That's why I tattoo myself, to mark the things I've done and seen, so I won't forget.
I studied his face again, with the swirling dark lines etched over his bronze skin and the invisible sun symbol on his throat.
You're Maori?
My grandfather was.
I don't think I've ever seen a soldier with facial tattoos like that.
I didn't get them until after I left. In fact, I didn't know I was Maori until then. I was no one. just another face among faces. But you see, that's the crime. I didn't know. My ancestors had a whole culture, a whole way of understanding the world. They suffered through disease and poverty. They fought back. They held on. But I knew none of that. When I left the military, I found out about my grandfather. I learned all I could about the people I came from. I still don't pretend to understand everything about them, even though I am one of them.
He pointed to his face.
But I won't forget it again.
Behind us, the voices of the litany continued.
Second Tokemura accident, Japan.
1999.
Baia Mare cyanide spill, Romania.
2000.
Lest we forget.
Lest we forget.
Gao Qiao.
All this weight of history. I mean, you would think I would understand it. I teach it. But there's so much. I tried to get my students to see beyond the dates and names, to understand why we learn history. But they never seemed to care. They didn't try. So I think I stopped trying, too.
He nodded at me like he understood.
Because you tried to bear it alone.
He held out one of his arms toward me and pointed to a spot on his wrist, a blank patch of skin on his otherwise tattooed arms.
When we get home, I'm going to put a tattoo here for Evan. We'll remember him. And you won't have to remember him alone.
His face had that same serenity I remembered from the subway station. That calm assurance. Unshakable. Certain. He made me think, for just a moment, that everything was going to be okay. It felt like the nicest thing anyone had ever done for me. There was a sudden buzz from the airlock next to us. Lights on the control panel flicked on. Air hissed. Then all went quiet. Matthew hurried back to the litany, sliding subtly behind Sister Lucy and murmuring to her between her intonations of historical, toxic tragedies. She tried to hide a sudden excitement in her eyes, to retain some ceremonial composure, but I could see it. Her next intonation brought the litany to a close.
These are but some of the things we do to ourselves. Come together and speak of these times, for our memories are fragile and fleeting, and to forget is the greatest sin. Amen.
Amen.
The group quietly dissolved into knots of people, conversing softly with each other. Sister Lucy approached Baptiste, whispered to him, and then the foreman began to gently encourage people to depart. Lucy, Matthew, and Oliver moved to join me at the airlock. As the crowd left, I saw Catherine adroitly navigating through them to come in. Barwise was alone in his bed, eyes closed.
Open it, please, Oliver.
Sister Lucy was staring at the airlock with an intensity I had not seen in her before. As if she was doing all she could to suppress, what, excitement? Anxiety? I must admit, I felt it a little too. Catherine stopped near me, watching.
Where'd you go? Just making sure the refueling was done. Big man said we'd have to leave in a hurry, so.
She was coming with us. I was admittedly happy about that.
You missed the litany. The what? Never mind. I'll explain it to you later.
Oliver tapped a few keys on the control panel, prompting a momentary alarm from it. The inner door of the airlock slid open, and almost immediately, plumes of white vapor rushed out, sinking to the floor and spreading. With it came a sour chemical odor that made my nose itch. Inside the airlock was an irregular chunk of ice the size of a child, which was rapidly sublimating in the warm air of the station, cracking and hissing. Oliver leaned back a bit from the rush of fog, alarmed. Catherine reflexively covered her mouth and nose with a hand. Lucy stood in the middle of it, surrounded by the swirling vapor, ignoring the pops of breaking ice that sent little shards flying out of the airlock. The ice turned out to be camouflage, In a couple of minutes, it had boiled away enough to reveal what was underneath. A metal cylinder, perhaps half a meter long and half that much in diameter. A boxy attachment was welded to its side, marked with electrical warning symbols. It looked very sturdy. Sister Lucy reached for it with both hands, but Matthew stopped her with a touch to her shoulder.
Wait.
He found a couple of rags nearby to shield his hands and gingerly tested the surface of the metal. Satisfied it wasn't going to give him frostbite, he picked up the device like it were a baby and lifted it from the airlock. It was humming very faintly. Sister Lucy fidgeted, staring at it.
Open it.
Oliver frowned.
We can't open it. It'll break the magnetic field. We'll lose it.
Not like that. There's a window. One side should slide open. A shutter.
Matthew studied the surface of the cylinder and clicked a little latch thereon. A small square of the metal skin of the cylinder slid upwards, exposing a glass core. We all leaned in to peer inside. Purple light shined out of the device from behind the thick glass, lighting up the grungy salvage compartment and our rapt faces. There was some sort of power coursing through that cylinder, the source of the hum. Moments of silence passed as we all stared. There was nothing there. I was looking, but I didn't see anything, just an empty glass cylinder filled with light. Lucy was making restless fists with her hands. She stared with all her might. Oliver squinted a bit, tilted his head. Catherine looked confused. After a few moments, Oliver said aloud what we were all thinking.
Are you sure it's there?
Catherine murmured to me.
Is what there?
I didn't know how to answer that question without sounding insane. Sister Lucy took a self-soothing deep breath.
It is there. The device is sealed and on power.
Okay, yes. But are you sure? I mean, we don't want to take this all the way back to Earth and announce we have proof of an alien species, which Shayot is somehow using to kill us all, only to show everyone a bloody empty can.
Lucy turned and launched herself back toward where Aubrey Barwise lay in his bed.
Bring it here.
We all followed, and Matthew set the cylinder on the bedside table where Barwise could see it. Sister Lucy gently shook Barwise's shoulder.
Aubrey. Aubrey, wake up, please.
Barwise stirred, his bruised eyelids flickering open, his bloodshot eyes darting about uncertainly for a moment.
Aubrey, look. Look.
The ruined man's gaze eventually lit upon the soft, purple radiance that shone from the open shutter. Lucy gestured for Matthew to bring the cylinder closer.
Look. Do you see?
His eyes grew wide. His lips parted and his eyebrows lifted in an expression of ecstasy and wonder. The computerized voice interpreted the twitches of his throat and lips.
I see. I see. It is there. I.
Tears rose and trickled down his cheeks.
Sister, do you see it too?
Lucy looked back and forth between Barwise and the cylinder, frustrated. She leaned in to stare at the purple light, the glow making her look even more tired and stretched. She had a hold of Barwise's sheets and was twisting them in her fingers like she was strangling them. Then she lied to him.
Yes. Yes, I see it. Thank you, Aubrey. We will tell them. We will tell everyone.
The effort had tired Barwise, and his eyes closed again.
Very well. Let us go.
So, I'm just gonna say it. Can we take his word for it?
Sister Lucy frowned sharply, and for the first time since I'd met her, I think she lost her temper. She rounded on Oliver.
Of course we can.
after all we have been through, all we have lost. You think Aubrey would lie to us? Are you having doubts now, of all times?
Don't you dare.
I've seen enough to know that something is going on. And if it's the angels, well, fine. I think that's just as good an explanation as any. I think I've proven my dedication to this group many times over. All I'm saying is that the entire future of what we're doing might hinge on what is in there. And if there isn't anything, then we will lose all credibility and the few faithful we have left will fall apart. So I'm asking, can we take the word of a man who is clearly sick and might not be in his right mind? Everything depends on this.
Lucy tore her angry gaze from Oliver and stared in frustration at the cylinder again. She looked near tears.
Can none of you see anything?
We all looked again. I found it hard to stare into the window for long. The light seemed to be blurring my vision, making my eyes hurt. But there was nothing there.
I'm sorry, I don't. No.
Catherine studied all of us, one at a time.
What should I be seeing? What is this eye? You would know if you saw. Oh, very helpful, thanks.
She shot a glance toward the exit. Lucy tugged at my sleeve.
Christopher, you are sure you don't see anything? I'm sorry, I don't.
She placed her hand on my elbow, encouraging me closer.
Please, look again. You have heard the angels, felt their touch. You, of all of us, should be able to see.
Gamely, I took another look. The light stung, and I had to blink several times to try to focus. Everything seemed blurry, and like there were transparent floating squiggles in my field of vision. But apart from that, there was nothing. Except, for a moment, there was something. Those little ghostly lines seemed to be coalescing around a shape. Something roughly spherical, the size of a fist. For a moment it was there, then it was gone. Did I see it? But then it appeared again, not any clearer, but there. This translucent half-image faded in and out of my perception, rarely lingering, but then coming back when I had lost it.
Yes? There's something? It's like a sphere, I think? It keeps fading out, and I can't really see it. It looks transparent to me, but I get a sense of shape. Yes, I think there's something in there.
Catherine wearily massaged her temples.
Christopher.
Her face was worried and defeated.
I know, but I do see something. I think... No, Christopher, you're just seeing what you want to see.
Oliver leaned in closer, putting a hand on my shoulder.
I want to believe you, and it looks like you're the only second opinion we have. But we need to be sure. Do you see something there or not?
I forced myself to stare at the light. Pain bloomed in my head like a migraine, but I didn't stop. Sometimes the shape was there. Sometimes it wasn't. But it kept appearing over and over the more I looked. Did I want to see it? Was it my brain tricking me? How could I tell the difference? Maybe I couldn't. In which case, all I had was what I saw. And I saw it. Sometimes.
I see it. I'm sure.
Sister Lucy squeezed my arm.
That is enough for me then. Matthew, pack it up. We need to go.
Matthew slid the panel on the device closed, and the purple light vanished. He put the cylinder in the satchel he brought with him from Mars. Oliver went to collect his things, and Lucy took a moment to tuck Barwise in and kiss his hand.
Go.
Catherine was staring at all of us.
You mean, you want me to fly you back to Earth? It would be a help to us, yes. This is insane. You people must stop.
I don't know what sort of weird cult you all belong to, but you're not going to drag me into it any more than you have.
Catherine, I know this is hard to believe, but I have
hard
been...
to believe? Invisible aliens? Angels? Some sort of worldwide cover-up? Christopher, can you just listen to these people? And listen to yourself?
Look, I saw...
There's nothing in that cylinder!
You haven't seen what I've seen.
Neither have you. Look, just stop. All of you, just turn yourselves in before something terrible happens. Please.
Sister Lucy stepped forward, very calm.
If you cannot help us, we will not make you.
Matthew spoke up now. His satchel was slung over his shoulder, his hands at his side, but there's a preparedness in the way he's balanced and positioned. Ready to move. Ready to attack.
Lucy, we can't wait.
Can we borrow another ship?
I don't think any of the ships here have twine drive. Just the freighters.
Can we wait for a freighter or other gate-capable transport?
That could be days. Maybe a week.
Shayad will be all over us by then. Perhaps Baptiste has a twine drive ship. They would likely have something for the foreman to use, or for emergencies.
Will you all please just stop?
We cannot. Can we use your ship?
The two of them stared each other down for a moment. The silence stretched as we waited for Catherine's answer. But it never came. An alarm sounded, echoing throughout Marley Station. Warning lights near the ceiling flashed yellow. We all startled and stared, frozen, as it cut through the quiet compartment. Baptiste's voice came over some hidden speaker.
Security alert. Main protection C. Hold them in their little hole, mes amis. They will kill us if we let them.
Shit. They're here.
Oh, Christ. What do we do?
If we had pressure suits, we could maybe make our way around the station on the outside.
We left the pressure suits from Mars and Catherine's ship.
And there's only one emergency suit here. Lucy, put on the suit. Take the eye. Make your way around anti-spinward. Catherine's ship is at the bottom of Section D.
What? Hey, you're not taking my...
I cannot pilot it. It would only delay the inevitable. Besides, if it's Shayot, they've got control of the gate. Even if we could get to her ship, we couldn't activate their gate to get anywhere. There is the chapel.
Everyone except Catherine and I exchanged knowing, worried glances and fell silent. Oliver rubbed his wrinkled face.
I don't think they're ready.
This is crazy. Just give up.
Oliver,
oh my God.
Do you have any sort of map of this station?
Oliver's fingers were jittery as he pulled out his tablet.
I don't know. What kind of detail do you need?
Basic is fine.
Baptiste's voice came over the intercom, just in our room, I think.
Sister, they want you badly. A ship just docked at Shayot's wing of our station, filled with soldiers. They've demanded your surrender. I suggest that they surrender to us instead. But they are as stubborn as they are corrupt.
I'm sorry, Mr. Baptiste.
This has been a long time coming. One cannot keep a secret forever. We will hold them as long as we can, but I cannot guarantee your safety. Whatever you're going to do it quickly.
Baptiste, could you get your people out of Section C and hold them at...
He squinted at the map. It was a maze of compartments and corridors sprouting from the asteroid. I had no idea how he could make any sense of it.
Junction D-17.
We will. You have something?
Gonna try to buy us some more time. Better tell the chapel we'll need them.
They will be excited to hear it. Good luck.
The intercom cut out, and Matthew checked his satchel.
All right. We need to go. All of us.
Oliver and Lucy rushed ahead. Matthew looked at Catherine and I expectantly. Catherine hesitated, her brows creased, her face sad.
Christopher, please. This is wrong.
We need your ship. Are you coming?
She pursed her lips and then started for the door along with us.
So much for having choices.
An Invisible Sun is written, produced, performed, and composed by W. Keith Timms, and is a production of Alien Ghost Robot Creative Media. If you're enjoying the story, please tell your friends and family about it, and leave stars or reviews on your favorite podcast platforms. I hope you'll join us on our Discord server, or sign up for our mailing list so we can stay in touch. Members of our Patreon get to hear future episodes early, plus other cool perks for all our shows. Go to InvisibleSunPod.com for more information.